From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in a high school classroom where a student named Rachel was struggling with a mental health condition, but didn't know it. At 15 years old, Rachel's stress and anxiety caused her hair to fall out, and she hid the urge to throw up in school. She thought her friends would, quote, just up and leave her one day. Now, Rachel graduated from high school and went off to college, but her symptoms became worse. After 2 years, she felt she had to leave. She called her mother, crying, and said she couldn't do it anymore. And after a few more years, Rachel finally found a doctor who was able to help her. He had diagnosed her with anxiety and referred her to a counselor, setting her on a path to recovery. Rachel shared her story in a piece called How My Life Would Have Been Different If I Had Mental Health Education in High School. Writing for the online publication The Mighty, she writes the following, quote, high school health class teachers teach students about safe sex, the dangers of drunk driving and drugs, but why is mental health never a focus in high school health classes? If health classes taught about mental health, I would have realized it was not okay to swallow back the puke every day. I would have realized it was not normal to have my hair falling out at such a young age, or to believe that one day my friends would decide to hate me. I would have realized it was not okay that the thought of college would make me physically ill. I lacked in self-confidence in high school, and I believe if I had this education then, my confidence would have been greater. I would have realized what I was experiencing and feeling was something I should be concerned with, and not every teenager felt this way every day. I would have been able to get some help. End quote. And Rachel's story is not uncommon. According to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, 1 in 5 youth lives with a mental health condition, but less than half of those individuals receive any treatment. Parents and teachers across the state have advocated for mental health education in schools, and starting on July 1st, New York becomes the first state in the country to require curricula on mental health at all grade levels. This hour, our guests discuss what they'd like those lesson plans to look like, why they feel this is long overdue, and we've got a lot to tell you about what's happening in our community as well. So let me go ahead and say hello to our guests in studio. The event coordinator and walk manager for NAMI Rochester is Christina Mosgraber. The walk's coming up. We'll talk about that coming up. Good to have you back here. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Tamara Minter is a retired Rochester City School District Administrator who oversees the Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority's Health Promotion Committee. Tamara, welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Janine Sanger is Coordinator of Health and Wellness for the Webster Central School District. Janine, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Heather Newton is a parent and the Director of Development at FoodLink. Heather, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
I want to ask all of you if you can tell me how you feel hearing the account of Rachel that we just quoted there, that this is one person whose story, every story is unique, but this story, when we say it's common, every person is unique, but this is something that, you know, she's saying, if I would have known, if you would have put mental health in health class, I might have had a better chance earlier in my life. What do you think, Christina?
Well, that story resonates very much with me because that's, you know, a thought that I've had. You know, I struggled with my symptoms from 10 to my diagnosis at 34. And I look back on it and I think, wow, if I'd known, my experience would have been different. But I try not to dwell on that and just find the positivity in the fact that we're making changes now. And this new law is incredible to me. So it's a really exciting time.
I wonder how you feel about that, Tamara, having been a school district administrator.
Well, I was an administrator as well as a teacher. Mm-hmm. And one of the roles that I had, I was a support teacher for children with emotional disturbance. So I saw a lot of that when children would come into school. And I often had to figure out what was making them so anxious. And how can we do problem solving? So there is certainly, we're way past in getting help for children coming to school. As early as kindergarten, because I worked with children who really had great difficulty as young as age 5, and I worked at the elementary school and the high school, then of course the issues are different for the high school students, but the idea of having anxiety hits everyone.
All right, let's go around the table with Janine Sanger, who is Coordinator of Health and Wellness for the Webster Central School District. Do you agree what you just heard from Tamara there?
I do. The story that you just relayed makes me feel sick inside and sad for that young lady, and I know that there are students out there feeling those things. I think in Monroe County, we're on a great trajectory because we are really on a path to increase adults' awareness of these needs in our schools, and we're doing some good things to meet those needs.
And Heather Newton, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree that with everything that's been said. I think as a parent of a child who is now heading toward his 18th birthday, but was diagnosed at a fairly young age, at 14 years old, one of our greatest challenges as a family was stigma. And, you know, it is hard enough to have a child who you know is needs help, but it's also very difficult. Our first entree into the mental health system was sitting in an emergency room for 36 hours before we were seen by a doctor. And our story is not remotely unusual. There are many, many, many stories out there that are far more difficult to listen to than our own. And I think the fact that not only the adults in our community are having this conversation, I've noticed even in my younger two children that this conversation is far overdue, and I'm really pleased that it's happening, and I'm thrilled that New York State is passing this law.
Well, we've talked so much about stigma and how there's this idea that mental health is health, but how in the world is it not taught in health class if it is health? Let me read an email from Christine in Rochester. She says, I remember when I was in high school and my anxiety was really bad, having panic attacks almost every other hour and restricting heavily. And I tried talking to my teachers about it. Instead of concern and help, they told me that I don't know what real anxiety is. I'm just a kid. I'm not even in the real world yet. I have it easy. So I continued eating about an apple or so a day and self-harming on my legs because I didn't want anyone judging me for having that more noticeable. Maybe if I had been educated sooner that having mental illness doesn't make you weak or an attention seeker, I would have sought help sooner. But instead, I fell into the addictive cycle of restriction and self-harm again, on my actual arm this time, much easier because the skin is softer. So mental health should be taught in schools to not only help students, but also help educators. Some teachers may suffer themselves and not even know because of their own lack of knowledge. Learning even basic coping skills or warning signs can help others become more aware of when someone needs help but doesn't know it. That's from Christina Rochester. What do you think, Christina?
I think that's fantastic. I agree with so much that my heart breaks for her high school experience, but I'm glad that she's speaking out about it and the need for it. I'm seeing so much because I'm in the school so much. I see in the evaluations the kids consistently saying, wow, I had no idea. Wow, now I know warning signs. I know that it doesn't make me weak or weird. And then I'll also get ones where, you know, I had a seventh grader last school year who wrote, I tried to commit suicide over the summer and this helped me greatly. And I watched, you know, they're anonymous evaluations, but I always kind of watch the kids, and I was able to, you know, talk to the counselor. And she said, I had no idea. And so they're able to talk to her and get her help and everything. But it's incredible how much the kids keep inside and feel like they have to. But I think this conversation is going to help them get it out.
Okay. I wonder, Heather, how you feel as a parent if a teacher ever said to your child, you know, oh, look, get over it. You don't even know what the real world is like. You've got it easy right now.
Well, I would certainly beg to differ, and I would say, based on my own personal high school experience and knowing now that I have two teenagers, that their anxiety is absolutely incredibly real and incredibly valid. And no, it's not necessarily working and balancing other things that we as adults are balancing in life, but high school is a very, very stressful environment, and becoming even more so with the pressure of college and lots of other things that kids are dealing with. So I think it's wonderful that these kids are feeling much more comfortable talking about anxiety, depression, and that the adults in their lives are listening.
Tamara, how do you feel about a student being told to sort of, hey, suck it up and deal? That's life.
Well, I'm listening to Heather, and I'm making an assumption. She's in a two-parent family. The children are there. I've known Christina Mossgrabber for a long time. I taught at school 16, and her family lived in the neighborhood, and all the children came through that school. She has two parents. Her mother was very involved, volunteering in the school, and then later getting a position there. So we often think that poor children, children that come from one-parent family, are the only children that have issues around anxiety, but that's not the case. Children that come from parents, working class, middle class, upper middle class. In fact, one of my friends, I asked her if she would give me a donation for the NAMI, a walk, and she said, yes, I have always supported NAMI. She's a retired administrator. Her district would be Pittsford Schools. And she's saying that, you know what, I'm into this because I know that there needs to be help for the young people.
Well, let me ask Janine, who is with Webster Central School District. What I don't know is prior to July 1, when the law kicks in, how often are schools teaching mental health, to your knowledge, I guess? And then let's ask all of our panelists what ideal mental health education looks like, really at all grade levels. I mean, starting in maybe even kindergarten. So, but is it taught at all with any routine, Janine, that you know of?
It is. I can speak to Webster, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
But we have quite a rich social learning curriculum that starts with kindergarten, and we talk about feelings, comfortable feelings, uncomfortable feelings. We talk about feelings of anxiety, what to do with those feelings. So that is talked about very, very early in terms of happy, sad, mad, and all of those things. And, of course, it spirals up in terms of complexity in throughout elementary. Middle and high school, I have the great benefit of supervising the health curriculum, and we absolutely have mental health instruction grades 6 through 12. And we bring in NAMI, and we're pleased to have them as a partner in our schools. I can, speaking for Webster, I feel like we're in a good place. We can certainly enhance.
And if you're on the phone, listeners, we've got a couple calls, which we'll get to in a moment, but I want to ask our guests what your expectations are or what they should be now that the law says, and New York's the first state in the country to say, you've got to teach this in schools, and you should do it at all grade levels. So starting when and what's appropriate? I mean, I guess you kind of gave us a little picture there, Janine, about how Webster does it.
Mm-hmm.
Starting in kindergarten? Starting in first grade?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
And even if it's if there's preschool experiences or pre-kindergarten, starting there, giving kids the vocabulary and the tools to interact with each other and identify feelings in themselves and be able to talk about those.
Okay, and then when you teach it at middle and high school level, you can certainly do so with a lot more depth.
Absolutely.
Can you also teach about stigma? Can you teach about, you know, does that sort of dovetail with explaining what disorders are?
It does, and I think if the more we talk about it, the more we normalize it, which will contradict that stigma. We've had, we have discussions about when you see a friend who seems to be struggling in one way, shape, or form, beyond you speaking with that friend, who do you reach out to assist them? So there are some pretty rich conversations that happen about, doing away with the stigma and reaching out for yourself and for others.
Okay. Heather, how do you feel about what your expectation, really as a parent now, should be for schools? What should our expectation be for how kids are taught mental health in schools?
You know, I would agree with a lot of what Janine said. I mean, I think that there are no ages too young to begin talking about feelings openly. So, of course, one needs to calibrate. Schools need to calibrate. Parents need to calibrate for a child's age. We have, in my family, my son is nearing 18. My daughter is 15. And we have an 11-year-old son. And so for my younger son's entire life, he has had conversations with us very much pertaining particularly to his brother, but all of us. And what I would say going through this experience very intensely for the past 4 years is that the more you have conversations with your children, with your family, the more open you can be about your own mental health, the easier it is to embrace what's happening in the larger community. And so I would say that, honestly, I think the place we probably need to start is teacher training. And getting teachers really comfortable about talking about their own mental health issues and experiences and the addictive process and many of the other things that are layered within the mental health arena, and then begin to talk to kids, because kids are incredibly intuitive. And if teachers and parents aren't comfortable having these conversations, it's not an appropriate place to sit down and talk to kids.
Okay, Christina?
I very much agree with what Heather and Janine just said. And one thing that both of them have great, great points. One thing that I talk about a lot, too, is the language. Even as adults, we don't know the words. Mm-hmm. We don't know the right words to use. And so teaching kids as early as kindergarten, preschool even, about feelings, about the words, about how to speak up for yourself, about it's okay to talk about feelings. You know, even that sounds so fundamental, but it's so huge at that age, especially. And I agree completely, too, with Heather about educating the parents and the teachers. And we have programs at NAMI that do that, because NAMI recognizes that we can't teach the kids in the school and have them go home and speak probably another language to their parents who are about my age and didn't grow up with this kind of education. So they might not know how to respond. So we offer that.
I want to grab a couple of phone calls, starting with a guest who is not only with the Mental Health Association of Rochester, but now a member of the Rochester City School Board. It's Melanie Funches. Hi, Melanie. Go ahead.
Hey, I'm so glad that we're having this conversation. And what I wanted to say was that we need to, I agree with everything that's been said. I'd also like to add that we really need to have these conversations be culturally responsive. That we really need to understand that the way mental health is languaged is different across different communities. And if we are going to teach, we have to be able to have not just teachers, but staff, lunchroom attendants, bus monitors, everyone that has contact in the life of kids in our school be comfortable with having culturally responsive conversations, because not every child is going to necessarily connect with the teacher. Some will connect with a sentry. Some will connect with a lunch lady. Some will connect, you know, with a school maintenance person. And if we're going to do this education, we also need to couple it with creating a culture in our schools that is very open and affirming around people being open and honest about their stuff. Because everything we do with the adults and lives of children is modeling and teaching.
So well said, Melanie. I wonder if our guests want to add anything there. Get a lot of smiles and nods in there. Go ahead, Tamara.
So one of the things that I did as a support teacher, and when I worked in the Rochester City School Districts, I worked at School 44, 29, School 36, School 7. And one of the things I would do was have breakfast with children. And the children would ask me, could they have breakfast with me? And I would say, sure. And it was difficult to help the teacher understand it was not a reward. It was a way for the child to connect with me. And it was a positive way for that child. So that child had something to look forward to. So he or she would say, I want to have breakfast with you. There were some expectations there. The child also realized that they maybe needed some time where they wouldn't be so anxious and also be able to connect. So Melanie is right. As a woman of color, I was able to reach all of the children because it really wasn't based on the skin color that I have. It was based on me really caring about them, but it made it a little approachable. So one of the things I had to say to the teachers, this is not a reward. It's not based on his or her behavior on the previous day. It's based on me giving that student an outlet, knowing that you can start your day positively. You can talk to me. Maybe there's something on your mind when you come into school that you may not share with your teachers. So this is an opportunity for you to share, to talk to someone, and I'm able to gain their trust. So when you do have really anxious moments, I'm one of the staff members that you'll look to, that you'll reach out to. So it's very important for our children to understand that there are people within the school environment that do care, and it's not just your classroom teacher.
Melanie, before we let you go, can I just ask you, because you wear a lot of hats in this community now, and I wonder, you know, when people hear that New York State is going to require mental health education in schools and that no other state's doing that right now, I think that would surprise some people. But then we think back to our own education. I don't remember mental health education in school at all. And granted, memory is sort of a strange thing, but I don't think it happened at all when I was growing up. So do you think people, just assume that it is taught already, or do you think the opposite? Do you think the public still needs sort of an education on why mental health is health and should be taught and must be taught?
I think that our community needs an education on that mental health is health, but also what mental health is and what mental health isn't. And so we, as a community, we are carrying a lot of myths, stigmas, and misconceptions around mental health as a community at large. So we need to not only educate our kids in school, but we also need to educate our parents, because like another one of your guests said, if there's one language being spoken in school and another language being spoken at home, because of the way, the relational way we are, the stuff that is taught in school can be counteracted at home if we don't all speak the same language. So, to answer your question, I don't think it was, I know it was not taught in school. And two, we don't teach it well as a community all the time, unless it's a reactive thing because we don't get into it until something happens to one of our kids or someone in our family is affected. Then we go and we learn. So if we could start the community conversation, which is something that we've been doing at the Mental Health Association for years, is about normalizing in our community to talk about mental wellness and how to maintain your mental wellness. But the only other thing I wanted to add before I go is we also need to talk about trauma. And we have got to help our children to understand it's not what's wrong with you, but it's what happened to you. And if we're talking about these things that so our children can understand that what trauma is and that it happens, and that the adults in their lives also understand it, so that we can have effective conversations as part of our community education and our changing of the culture.
Melanie, as always, it's great to hear from you.
I know it's a lot.
Thank you. No, it is, but thank you.
Thanks, Evan.
Thanks, as always. That's Melanie Funches, who's with the Mental Health Association and the Rochester City School Board. And that let me also tell the other caller on the line, Lyndon Webster, who wants to weigh in on similar subjects. Please stay there. We're going to come to you in a moment. You know, Melanie's last point about trauma, Janine Sanger, who's coordinator of health and wellness for the Webster Central School District, was talking to us before the hour began about the Youth Risk Behavior Survey that helps sort of flesh out just how prevalent mental health disorders are. And, you know, Melanie's right. Trauma is sadly common. It can be very difficult and devastating for kids. And what have we learned from something like the Youth Risk Behavior Survey about our community?
I'm glad that you asked that. Within the Youth Risk Behavior Survey, there are questions about the ACEs, which is the Adverse Childhood Experiences. So that is, I think, what Melanie was referring to in terms of trauma. And it's not trauma in the sense that many people think about trauma, something very big and dramatic, and those are traumas, obviously, but it's also something as common as living in a single-parent household or divorce of parents. It is if you have a parent that abuses substances. There are a variety of things, and we ask those questions on the Youth Risk Behavior Survey to find out what level of ACEs, those adverse childhood experiences, are prevalent in each one of our districts and in the county. And we're seeing that they're very, very prevalent no matter where the children lives or goes to school. And we're also realizing, as Tamara said, that the impact of one significant adult relationship can actually reverse the impact of those ACEs. So what you were saying was exactly right, that it's so important that we form those relationships, not only around combating mental health issues, but what children have experienced up to this time.
Yeah, go ahead, Tamara.
I'm surprised, though, other states like California and Texas haven't, maybe not Texas, but California, with the influx of other children coming from other countries. Mm. That these children have suffered many traumas, that they will not get on the bandwagon and say, oh, yes, we must provide support. We certainly have had an influx of children that survived the storms of the past seasons. These children have been traumatized. They lived without electricity, food, and clean water. And then many of them have relocated to our community. These children have been traumatized.
Yes.
So we may think there is a myriad of ways that children are impacted.
Yes.
Well, there was a local event in March sponsored by the School Administrators Association of New York State and its partners. And some teachers at this event spoke about, this is sort of their point of view, and I'm curious to know if the guests agree. They believe all students should be treated as if they've endured trauma because educators don't know their backgrounds. And so the baseline assumption should be, I'm going to assume that you have had trauma in your life because I don't know. And the easier assumption, the better assumption is that you have until I learn that you haven't, as opposed to the other way around. Tamara, how do you feel about that?
I think all of us need some basics. I think that we should reach down to the preschool level children, that they have the language. I'm not so sure if I agree with that. I'm not so sure because you're making assumptions about people. I'm not so sure. So I would actually ask a licensed person to give a response.
It's complex, right? I mean, I think Tamara's not coming out saying bad idea right off the bat, but she's saying, you know, we've got to understand what that would mean to make that assumption. How do we feel about it, Janine?
And I think that person is referring to trauma-responsive education.
Yeah.
And it's so that people have an awareness that many people have experienced trauma. We won't necessarily be able to identify which trauma or who has what traumas, but everyone can benefit from that trauma-responsive approach. And I think that's probably what that person was referring to.
Okay, sure. Christina, you want to add to that? Because trauma-responsive care is important. And maybe if that's what the teachers are driving at here, you know, that is easier to kind of understand.
I'm guessing that is what they were driving for. And, you know, I'm that's not my area of expertise, but I completely agree that there needs to be more education, more sensitivity towards it. One thing, you know, when working with kids and even working with other adults, I use the language of you never know what somebody's been through. You never know, you know, they might be smiling. You never know what might be going on behind the smile. You never know where they've been. Everybody's story is different. So even just the basic level of human empathy and, you know, really encouraging that because you don't know. You know, you don't know what somebody's been through. And you don't want to assume, but you really don't know.
And Heather, do you want to take the viewpoint from a parent? What would you like teachers to at least, either whether it's an assumption about your children or at least an openness to their experience as opposed to maybe a closedness to different experience and mental health?
Sure. I mean, I think what just on the trauma front, what I would add is that having a, either being a person who is experiencing mental illness or being a family member or caregiver of somebody who's mentally ill is traumatic. Mm-hmm. So just from a mental illness standpoint, I would make that point. And then I would agree with everything that's been said, which is I'm not exactly sure what the approach is because I personally am not an educator, but I would certainly agree that a very baseline level of human empathy about people and the fact that you have no idea based on looking at them what they've been through makes an enormous amount of sense.
On Twitter, Isaac says, as a social worker and a therapist who works with kids, I'm so grateful you're having this conversation. This is incredibly important for all of the reasons you stated. I wish I had time to call in, but thank you. So thank you, Isaac, for listening. And let me grab Linda in Webster, who has been waiting. Let's go ahead, Linda.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And as a parent, I'd like to speak briefly about my daughter's experience and that she has had some mental health issues. And my point is that I think teachers need to recognize the symptoms or signs of what anxiety looks like, especially in elementary kids. And if they're picking up on something, to say something to the parent. It wasn't until years later that I found out how often my daughter went down to the nurse's office because she was feeling anxious about something, or how often, you know, she was not played with in elementary school or set aside or thought of differently. And I wish I had known, you know, I wish somebody would have told me this. I really do. And I think it's written off like, well, we don't want to upset the parent by telling about this or that or the other thing. And I'm saying, you know, get educated and tell a parent, you know, just, you know, in as soft and, you know, but truthful a way as possible. And it just would have had so much light a lot earlier. And I have to say this, my daughter did transfer to Webster Schools, and so I got to give a big shout out to Webster Schools and Webster High School. You guys were phenomenal with my daughter. And she would not have gone as far as she is right now without you guys. So thank you very much.
Thank you for saying so, Linda. I appreciate it. I hope she's doing well.
Oh, yes. Oh, she's doing great.
Great.
Linda, thank you for the phone call. And what we're going to do is we're going to take this moment to get our only break, but we're going to build off Linda's call when we come back. I want you to know what NAMI is working on for the community because you can get involved with their walk that's coming up. But part of the reason we're here as well, I talked to our guest before the hour, and parents like Heather Newton are saying, look, there are wonderful services and value that NAMI and groups like that have. And maybe you don't know, and maybe you've got a child who eventually you'll have a conversation and come to realize, well, there's mental illness in our family, but there are resources. So we got plenty of time. We're going to tell you about those things coming up. After our break, let's build off of Linda's question, because NPR in 2016, in a story titled Mental Health in Schools, A Hidden Crisis Affecting Millions of Students, asked the question, who should be the one to ask students what's wrong? And that NPR story took a look at the role, but then the reality, when we expect family or a teacher or a social worker, school psychologist, school nurse, principal, and more. And I think there's some really interesting and important stuff there. So we're going to mine that territory right when we come back here after our only break of the hour on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, the racist panel was removed from the Denzel Carousel up in Ontario Beach Park, and there's been a decision on how to replace it. That has sparked some community discussion. We'll tell you what will replace that old racist panel and why. And in our second hour, the high cost of dying. We'll talk about funerals, preparing, what you should know. Talk with you on Monday. Welcome back to Connections. And as we talk about mental health in our schools, reminder of a couple of things. Number one, the big news hook, the reason we're here is New York State's going to become the first state in the country that's going to require curriculum on mental health in schools at all levels. That starts this summer. Might surprise you that it's not required. It hasn't been, but it will be. But a lot of schools, Webster among them, they're represented on the panel today by Janine Sanger, have already taken it upon themselves to do that. And so we're talking about what that means with Janine Sanger from the Webster Central School District. Tamara Minter is retired from the Rochester City School District and overseeing the Alpha Kappa Alpha Sororities Health Promotion Committee. Heather Newton's a parent. Christina Mosgraber is Christina Mosgraber. She's events coordinator and walk manager for NAMU Rochester. And speaking of, as the walk manager, your big day is coming up. It's an important day for the National Alliance on Mental Illness's Rochester chapter. What's going on with that?
So the walk is our biggest fundraiser. That is how we can offer all the programs we do at no cost to the community. So it's a really, it's a big celebration too. People asked over the years, ooh, are we going to talk serious science? Or it's not that at all. It's a big celebration of recovery. There's all kinds of different activities. We're also going to be doing Narcan training too, because that's another partnership we're really, really big on, is making sure people know about resources for addictive disorders as well. So Narcan training is a big part of it, which is really exciting. There's all kinds of great stuff. It is May 5th at the Village Gate Square. If you wake up that morning and want to come down, you can. There's no registration fee, but we do encourage you to register beforehand. And it's, again, just a great thing, and it's a great support for NAMI and supports those programs we do in the schools.
All right, so one more time to register, where to do it?
You go to NAMIROC, so that's namiroc.org, and click on the button for the NAMI Walks event.
Simple to do it.
And very, very simple.
Coming up Saturday, May 5th at the Village Gate Square. Have a good time with that. And Tamara, go ahead.
My organization, in the past couple years, we participated in the NAMI Walk. However, we have a conflict. So the Delta Nu Omega chapter here in Rochester, of Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority, we're having our own little walk on this Saturday because we can't get there on May 5th. So last year, we had Ms. Tanya Davis, who organized our own walk. It's an awareness, and we are raising funds. We'll be at the Cobbs Hill Reservoir. All you have to do is just show up, and we're walking the reservoir. And if you want to bring a donation, the monies that are donated on Saturday, April 28th, will be given to NAMI. We'll be at the reservoir at 9 o'clock, and we're going to be there till 10 o'clock. Bring a friend, bring your dog, cat, anyone that will walk with you. We're just trying to bring awareness so when we walk around the reservoir, people will ask us, what are you doing? And we will say we're raising funds and awareness for mental illness.
Okay, so 9 to 10, Cobbs Hill Reservoir, Saturday. That's tomorrow. Is
yeah,
that tomorrow?
That's tomorrow.
Oh, that is tomorrow.
And we're getting going to have good weather.
You are. We can't say the same for Sunday, but tomorrow, yes. Okay, so you're up to speed there, and let's get back to some of what Linda was saying, and I want to explore this territory on who should be asking students what's wrong. And let me just read a little bit from NPR's 2016 report on mental health in schools on this. They start with family. And a little bit before we dive into what NPR said, I think Tamara makes an important point that trauma happens, and trauma happens more often in terms of statistics in single-parent households or in with students who are growing up in poverty. And so when we talk about family, it's different from case to case. Sometimes there's a single parent working two or three jobs and just simply isn't always in contact with the kids during the day that they would like to have because they're just trying to get by. So they may miss a sign here and there, not out of neglect, but out of just necessity. But let me just go ahead and read from the NPR report. On the family, the role is the first place to spot trouble is in the home. Whether that trouble is substance abuse, slipping grades, or a child sleeping too much, adults at home, including parents, siblings, or other relatives, are often the first to notice something going on. The reality is many families do not know what to look for. Sometimes a serious problem can be overlooked as just a phase. But it's those sudden changes, angry outbursts, declining grades, changes in sleeping or eating that can signal problems. When something unusual crops up, families can keep in close touch with a school. Here's what they write about the teacher, the role of the teacher. During the week, many students see their teachers even more than their own families. Teachers are in a prime spot to notice changes in behavior. They read essays, see how students relate with other kids, and notice when they aren't paying attention. The reality is that teachers already have a lot on their plates. They're pressured to get test scores up, on top of preparing lessons and grading assignments. Plus, many teachers receive minimal training in mental health issues, but when they do see something concerning, they can raise a flag. I'm going to read one more section, and it's on the school psychologist. The role is, here's one job that on paper is truly dedicated to student mental health. School psychologists are key players when it comes to crisis intervention and can refer students to outside help, such as a psychiatrist. The reality, if you sense a pattern here, you're right. In the United States, there is just one school psychologist for every 1,400 students, according to the most recent data available from the National Association of School Psychologists. So that's just some of what the role, but the reality is in figuring out who needs to step in and ask a student if something is wrong. Let's go around the table and talk about, and this is complex, but Janine Sanger, Coordinator of Health and Wellness for the Webster Central School District, who is sort of, you know, how do you layer that in Webster? How do you approach that knowing that if we sense a student is really struggling more than just what is quote unquote normal or expected, who steps in?
I think that we have the conversation frequently enough with all adults in our system that any adult would feel comfortable coming forward. We have that conversation with coaches because sometimes those are the people that see kids more frequently or for a bit longer length of time than their parents do during the day. We have that conversation with bus drivers. We're doing youth mental health first aid training with our bus drivers coming up, and that's a certification program because sometimes, you know, they're going to see the kid at the first thing in the morning and then last at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And they have relationships with kids that nobody else does. It's a different kind of relationship. And we're also teaching our kids to speak up if they have a concern about another student. And we have in Webster, and I know their districts have this, it's called the Safe School Helpline. And if you see something that you're afraid for somebody's safety, if you're afraid they're going to hurt someone, hurt themselves, anything like that, they can make an anonymous call to a 24-hour hotline, and that will alert folks in the district that they need to reach out in one way, shape, or form. And we make sure that all kids 6 through 12 know about that service.
And when it comes to teachers, I was really struck by NPR's point there that, number one, teachers have a lot on their plates. There's a lot of pressure on standardized tests to begin with. There's a lot of work that teachers are already doing, but then a lot of teachers don't have training. Are you comfortable that that is changing, that the teachers are getting better trained to recognize mental health issues and understand this is beyond what is to be expected?
Absolutely. And I was pleased that Linda said she had moved to Webster and felt that she had her daughter had received the assistance that she needed. We all are also focusing on the adverse childhood experiences in our district. Every adult has been trained K-12 to know about what adverse childhood experiences are, those traumas that happened before the age of 18, and the impact that it has on a student, their ability to learn, their ability to focus, and what are some things we can do about that. So we have that language right now in our district.
Heather Newton, how do you feel about NPR's comparing sort of the role versus the reality of family, teachers, school psychologists, school staffs?
I think my initial response to that was exactly actually what Janine said, which is that I think the probably the first person in any child's life to realize that something's wrong is their friends. And I know that just in my experience as a parent, that those friends actually in our life have come forward to us, to teachers, to administrators. And so, again, I think that it's really important that we're talking to adults, but it's also important that kids have this language. Kids are really in tune with what's going on with one another. And it's important also, I think, that for any of the adults and any of the kids who are learning this information, who may learn it 6 months, a year, you know, 2 years after something really traumatic perhaps has happened in this child's life, to understand that it's not your fault. Just because you are the one who is bringing this to light, who is recognizing it, there's a lot of shame and guilt that comes along with mental illness. And it isn't just the person who's ill that carries that. It's a lot of people around them.
Such an important point. Tamara Minter, how do you feel about these different roles and realities?
I would think that it would have to be various persons within the school environment. The psychologist really would not have the time to develop a relationship. Children connect with adults based on relationships. Psychologists, I'm not sure what's happening right now in the Rochester City School District, but many of them were not full-time staff members. Many of them worked in two buildings, and many of them, their sole role was testing. There was a change under previous administrators where previous superintendent, where he wanted, because he was a counselor, he realized the need of psychologists, but the psychologists don't have time. So again, direct contact. Who are you seeing every day? Who do you see when you get off the bus? Who do you see when you go in the cafeteria to get your lunch? Yes, the nurse sees a lot of these children too, because they end up in the nurse's office, and many times the teacher will say, go see the nurse. The nurse has a relationship with the child, but there are other people within the school environment that children can connect with. Psychologists, yes, but I don't think the psychologists really have the time with their schedules to really connect with children the way that a child would say, oh, I'm going to go see Mr. Jones because he's a psychologist and I know I'll listen to him. The child might say, I'm going to go see Mrs. Blue, who works in the cafeteria. When I go in to get my lunch, I'm going to try to talk to her and let her know something is not going right in my life. And so I think that we just can't rely on one particular person. You don't have to be a licensed person to show caring. I think that's what I want to drive home. It's all about caring about children and being able to listen, because if you learn to listen, you will hear what the child is saying.
Christina, do you mind if I ask you a personal question on this?
No, not at all.
I know you've been very open about your own life experience. I mean, been a little while since you were in school, but did you recall?
Just turned 38.
I'm not dating you. I didn't. I'm just observing.
I'll date myself. It's okay.
But did this? Do you have any recollection of this coming up at all in school when you were younger, and then even in your adult life, were there people who you either felt more comfortable with or did step in to say, I'm noticing something?
So there's a lot of answers to those questions. So I'll go for the, you know, sake of brevity. I was actually taken out of school in sixth grade because my anxiety was so bad. And I had a home hospital. There was a program in the city school district. I had a tutor that came to my house, which I thought was awesome because I didn't have to go to school and I could do my work on the deck and everybody else still had to go to school. But then there was really no follow-up plan. You know, there's a lot of, we call it, it's just syndrome in my family, you know, because it was quite a long time ago and things are changing, but we knew there was something there, but we didn't have the tools. We didn't have the language. We didn't have that. A lot of, you know, what was really focused on, and I'm very proud of this, is accomplishments, you know, like being an athlete, being a good student, which are all wonderful things, but I think it was really important to see the whole person, see the whole student, you know, because looking back on it, I realized there were definitely very glaring signs that something was wrong. And, you know, people said something, and I think we didn't know what to do with it. I was just visiting my sister, who's 30, and I was rehearsing something for a conference I was presenting at, and I said something about, you know, people noticed, you know, the signs of my mental illness, but nobody really said anything. And she says, I said something, but you guys didn't listen because I was the baby of the family. And broke my heart. I cried, and I cried at the conference when I presented. But it's such an important message. Everybody, and especially to the point of their friends know them the best, you know, maybe the siblings. But listen, when somebody brings to your attention they're concerned about a loved one's or a student's mental health, take a moment to listen, you know, and then know what to do with it and get connected.
Before we have the hour run out on us on this Friday afternoon, we had a couple of our panelists who wanted to make sure we talk a little bit about understanding the value of NAMI and the resources that are available. And I'm going to start with Heather Newton, who's a parent. And that's, before the hour began, I just said, you know, what should we make sure that we don't lose this hour? And you said just the value of that kind of service. And I wonder, did you know much about NAMI before recent years?
No, I really knew nothing about NAMI until taking the family-to-family class, which is taught by those who have either lived experience or who are, parents, aunts, uncles. And that class in and of itself really gave me hope at a time when we were feeling as a family pretty hopeless. My husband and I are chairing the walk actually this year, and we're really proud to be a part of this community that is very peer and family driven, and it is a really nice place to go when you feel like you're all alone in the world, because you will quickly realize that, first of all, your story of course is unique, but it's not in any way, shape, or form unusual, and these are people that you can really have very, very candid conversations with.
Now, I know Tamara also wanted to make sure we talk a little bit about understanding a resource-rich community and some of what's out there.
Rochester is a very well developed community with resources, and it's not based on income. If you don't have money, it's no reason not to seek services. One of the facilities that we have is the Evelyn Brandon Center on Lake Avenue. And if you Google mental illness or mental health, Evelyn Brandon's name comes up. She was a person committed to working with people within the community. And these services in Rochester, for many of our residents, are free. So people should seek and ask questions. In your child's school, you can talk to the school nurse and a school psychologist. These people can direct you. Some schools may have a social worker, but there are resources there. So I just wanted to let the community know that there's support out there for all of us that we seek. I wanted to see what it was like to go to a facility. So I said, okay, I'm going to check myself in. I'm going to ask my primary care doctor. I wanted to see what people experience, and then I wanted to see the facility and how things are operated here in Rochester. The Rochester Mental Health Association, that's another place where you can seek resources. So there's just a lot here in Rochester. We're very blessed in this community that we have so much to offer.
Christina, you want to add to some of what you just heard about what you want people to understand about resources?
I agree with both what Mrs. Minter and what Heather said. I think, you know, I hear a lot of people say there aren't any resources. And, you know, I do a lot of work all over the place. And I can tell you, Rochester is a very rich in resource for mental health, for care and for, you know, other resources, because it's not just about going to a doctor and getting the right diagnosis and medication. It's about support for the person. It's about support for the family members, because, as I think Heather said earlier, it's a traumatic experience for the whole family. So Rochester really does have a lot of great resources.
And can I just ask a question from a listener? What should people do who need help if they're told places aren't accepting new patients? What if they feel they don't have any options to turn to? Is there a website with a list of resources?
I would recommend calling NAMI. We get a lot of calls about that. People will call, and we have a list of people who are accepting new patients and other options. So that's a big part of what we do, is connect people with other places. So I would recommend calling NAMI for that.
Okay. Good luck to the listener who sent that. John in Rochester wanted to know, has the panel considered the impact bullying can have on students with trauma and mental health? That's a word that hasn't come up much at all in this discussion. You want to take that one, Janine?
Sure. Yes, the impact of bullying, of true bullying, it can be devastating. One thing that we try to focus on in our district is delineating there's a continuum of what's conflict up to what's true bullying. Mm-hmm. And many folks, not saying that this person that's submitting this question that's their experience, but many folks use the term bullying very, very broadly. And when we talk about bullying, it's in a repeated fashion with a power differential, and it's intended to cause harm over and over again. So many times we have students talk about bullying when it's really just a form of conflict. So we do talk to kids about that and try to work out what is it? Where is it on that continuum of interaction? True bullying absolutely can be very, very devastating, and we need to pay attention to that when kids bring that up, and parents, absolutely.
And I'd like Heather Newton to take the last word on stigma. What would you like to see happen with stigma? And by the way, this is really cool for the NAMI walk coming up on Saturday, May 5th. You can use hashtag stigma free. Good for you guys.
It's you good, totally can.
It's a good hashtag. Some final thoughts on stigma from you.
Yeah, actually, I'm glad you brought up hashtag stigma free, because I think just saying the word stigma, let's eradicate the stigma. Let's talk about mental illness. I think one of the things that, part of this conversation has obviously been very heavy. And I think one of the things that I wanted to express is that I am so incredibly grateful for my son's experience and for the fact that we've had much more open dialogue in my family, not just about, the difficulty of living with mental illness, but about the joy of just paying attention to what's right in front of you and living in the moment. And I think that if we can all get beyond this curtain of stigma, we'll all be a lot happier.
Heather Newton's a parent, sharing her experience. Good luck to you and your family, and thank you for taking the time to be here this afternoon.
Thank you.
Christina Mosgraber, we'll see you May 5th, Saturday, May 5th, for the NAMI Walk at Village Gate Square. Register online now where, if you want to?
Go to namiroc.org and click on the NAMI Walks button.
NAMI Rochester, namirock.org, and again, an organization that will at least help you. If you feel like doors aren't open, that can help you find them. It's always great to have you. Thank you, Christina.
Thanks for having me.
Tamara Minter, retired from the Rochester City School District and overseeing Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority's Health Promotion Committee. Wonderful having you this hour. Thank you for being here, Tamara.
Thank you.
And our thanks to Janine Sanger from the Webster Central School District. Thanks for your expertise as well this hour.
Thank you so much.
John Andrus, engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a beautiful weekend. We'll be back with you Monday on member-supported public radio.